mean by smarter metadata, it's not just about driving a workflow, but it's about automating processes. What are the processes that are very repetitive or very complicated that need to be automated for consistency and for speed? What about the analytics? And analytics being in each one of those steps, whether it's post-production, distribution, analytics of what went right, what went wrong, what got delivered, what didn't get delivered. But then on the very end of the scale, in the consumption end, those analytics come all the way back through who viewed what? Did they view the whole piece of content? Was there problems with that view? Was there, what were the things that happened by the consumer that now feed all the way back through the food chain to the distributor, to the production company, back into the licensee? And so those are the areas that are really compounding. And when you look at things like machine learning and AI, it all sounds great, but it's a much more difficult equation than you can imagine. Especially when each one of the AI vendors today, and I don't mean just vendors, but people like the Microsofts of the world, Google, the Grey Metas, all those, they're all doing great work, and they all have exactly completely different APIs that don't talk to each other. There's a lot of replication that occurs that isn't rationalized. So what you end up is 100 times more data, then now you're still going to have to grind through to figure out what data is it that's valuable, how can I use it, how is it going to impact my content from one end to the other. So for us, it's important to see how it works and the fact that it's not just an element that is specific to a studio or a news gathering organization. So these are just some simple examples of some of our customers. And they're all, and when you look at it, they are literally all over the map physically and logically. AmFam, which is an insurance company, you know, they've got 40-some-odd thousand employees. But their metadata problems from their end of the world is very specific and highly secure because they're, as an insurance company, they're very risk-averse. So every step they've got has security, encryption, policies that are much deeper than we typically see in the media entertainment industry. So yes, media entertainment has its own difficulties, but it's much more structured than companies like this where their insurance companies have very difficult situations, and in a way they're just banks. You know, they get money in, they don't normally take money back out, but that's insurance companies. But as you can imagine, it's the way they do things looks awfully similar to what happens in a broadcast facility or a studio. There's another great example from an enterprise layer. Audi does something completely different, but if you look at those steps about doing things like uploading content from the agency, creating proxies, doing different renditions for every single bit of content they do, and having the metadata to track it, manage it, and follow it through all the way to publishing on the back end, look awfully similar, again, to what gets done in a typical video and broadcast facility. HBO, for their over-the-top platform, is moving everything completely over to our system. And you can see they've got a high security in everything they touch. So encryption, security, all those elements are based on fundamentals within the metadata modeling that they do. And that metadata, because it's a closed-loop metadata model, because it is over-the-top, everything that comes out one end has to come back and feed back to the system on the other end. So it's really much more of a closed-loop process, even though the high-level steps they've got are the same as most other organizations. ITV Studios is a great example where they start using metadata modeling way up in the planning. So their metadata structures are well-planned and executed through from the one end to the other. But it also means that early on when they're doing their first budgeting, that they're using metadata models to see how things propagate through the platform, the different deliverables they'll have on the back end. You can imagine it's fairly complicated in what they do, but there's a lot of steps that come out, things like, you know, being able to integrate things like auto QC systems, the color conform for different deliverables. Those are all layers of metadata that have to be built, managed, and propagated through to the endpoint. Intel Sports was a great example of something that happened very quickly last year, the 2018 Olympic Games. They started out with 50 pretty straightforward, simple metadata models, so metadata fields that they were using. That grew to 250 metadata fields. which they used to create 3,800 assets, 127,000 workflows in 2 weeks. So that was a massive undertaking, but they are one of the largest providers of 3D acquisition equipment. And actually down in, if you ever get a chance to go to El Segundo, they have the largest volumetric soundstage in the world. It's enough to put two full-size basketball courts in, and it's completely volumetric. So any angle, anywhere, any level, you can see images in a full 360 VR perspective. But again, this entire platform was driven by metadata. And again, it's about metadata being intelligent enough to drive workflows, drive processes. Sometimes those workflows are manual. It's about making sure that you don't have to repeat and re-enter manually, you know, the steps and the information that needs to be put in. So the last couple of them, Zone TV was one of the very first companies to actually start using the Microsoft Cognitive Services, and they started doing this early last year. So if you go onto Zone TV's website, you can personalize your television experience from start to finish. Everything you see out that you view, you get from commercials, you get from a content perspective, it's all customized based on your input into the system. And it's as you use it, it learns what you like watching, the different types of personnel, content, and it feeds that back to you with the right types of commercials, the right types of additional content that you may be interested in. And again, the entire system is driven by smart metadata. And finally, we have ZoomIn TV, which is the largest provider of over-the-top news in the world. So they do about 400 news articles every day, distributed in 40 different languages around the world. So from start to finish, their CRM platform is actually Salesforce.com. So they use Salesforce as a sales and marketing tool and to propagate what goes on from their system from one end to the other. So by and large, what we're talking about when we look at metadata, when we look at each particular deliverable, to go back to the original slides, sorry, this was not the jump thing that we had asked for, but so if we look back at, So we look back at these, you know, particular elements, and you look at each step in the puzzle, the amount of information that gets built up, the amount that's contained, is completely different in each case. So it doesn't matter whether you're in production or post, they're still using elements from one level to the other. So what's created in the business side is still going to be used all the way down in consumption. That's what smart metadata does. It does actions and reactions, and it informs the system from one end to the other on a consistent basis. Is there any questions that what we're talking about here? You have that question.
Me?
No, the woman in front of you.
Me?
I like the
awesome.
Kicking on wind. Happy birthday, by the way. So anyways, that's what we're talking about with smart metadata. And it does impact everybody in the food chain from one end to the other. The details are different whether you're doing news, sports, weather, theatrical release, or television. But each one of the phases is still going to be the same. And the depth of the information, the depth of the metadata that's in there is going to impact directly on how you do your job, how the people within the system get their jobs done. This presentation with some additional slides will be passed out as a PDF afterwards, so you can kind of go through there. You don't have to worry about taking pictures of everything. And I'll give you my information. It's also going to be in the PDF, so if you want to contact us for additional information, we're happy to inform you. So that's it. I'll try to make it quick.
Have a question.
Okay.
How much metadata, I mean, you know, when you're looking at data, it's so hard for organizations to find the actual correct amount of data that they're actually going to use, that's going to be useful, and not just take everything in the world. So that whole discovery is its own process, right? How much data do you find, percentage-wise, are people actually using? I mean, they, you know, the import is massive. in, specifically in post-production and in the television business?
Yeah, what we find is that a very small portion actually gets utilized today for all the data that's being generated. AI is kind of making it worse because you will never likely use one AI vendor. You will probably have many AI vendors, because each AI vendor has a different set of capabilities. And when you do that, they generate a lot of data. So, and the data is very specific to each frame of video. So you can imagine if you've got 30,000 frames of video, and there's data for each one of those frames, whether it's facial recognition, whether it's a logo recognition, or there was a Ford Mustang in the background, not a Camaro. Now, those types of things. All that information comes out, and it gets cataloged, and the usage model, though, is very low. I would say less than 10%. What does get used a lot is there's elements in here, like digital rights, that gets passed through the entire platform. It's painful sometimes, because those same digital rights, while you're using it, digital rights and encryption, the other parts of the puzzle can't do their work when it's encrypted, so it has to be decrypted. The work gets done, then re-encrypted again, and then passed on. By the time you get to the end, there's probably three or four layers of encryption, or DRM, sitting on one piece of content. So it's that's a massive problem. But yeah, the actual usage ends up being fairly thin. But that's why we look at this as separate models, where the information that Post has, let's say in distribution, there's a bunch of things, they don't care about what happened up here. You know, they've got a finished product, they want, and of course you've got great tools around that in the promo side. You only use so much of that information, that the rest of it is not really valuable to you. So you're not likely gonna pass that on to the next step, but you still have to have it, you still have to use it. So what we try to do is thin that out as much as possible so the user at each stage really only sees the information that they need to work with. They may see it as a reference, so they may just see a highlight of it, or they may have to click a couple of layers down because they really don't want to see it. At the same time, there may be areas where they need to enter information in. And there's that step that we think is always important, which is there's always a human element from one end to the other. That's the thing about this business. It's not completely automated from one end to the other. Some people would say that would be great if it was, but I'm not sure that would really work. So there is these human layers in there that have to be, tweaking the knobs, approving what's going out. We certainly have found times where things have multiplied. HDR is a good example, but HDR increases the size of each file, increases some complexities within the file, but also there's a whole separate level of deliverables on the back end. So your digital rights and everything may be the same, but what it plays out on, when you look at it on a phone, once that phone can support HDR, it's not going to play it back until it switches it back to SDR. So again, what we're seeing is that more and more of that information is valuable, but it's less valuable to somebody looking at it. It's more valuable to trigger something in an automated sense to make it work the way they want, because the consumer just flat doesn't care. They buy a 4K set, they want to see it in 4K. Problem is when it was shot in HD, and now that $3 chip inside the television set is up-resonant to 4K, it kind of looks the way it looks. We found the same thing with high frame rates. So, everybody looked at 120 frames per second, looks at it and says, that looks awful. And hey, we've only had a couple of movies that have been released with at high frame rate. Neither one of them did very well, and if you saw either one of them, you probably had the same reaction, like, did they shoot this with an old Sony Steadicam or something? Or I'm not sure what they shot it with, but it looks awful. So, but the metadata is there to make sure that things get done the way they should be done without having manual entries put in place. More and more of the subsystems that underlie each one of these phases is supporting automatic metadata ingest, so it knows what to do with that ultimately on the outgest side. Another layer of another good example is IMF. I don't know how many of you are familiar with IMF within the film and television industry, but IMF actually has directions on what's supposed to happen downstream. So something is packaged at post, but at distribution, they need to take it from an original high-res file down to a deliverable file. Well, there's instructions within the IMF package to say, oh yeah, you can do this type of transcode and but you can't touch the color, you know, the color space. So it has those directions, it happens automatically. And again, it's all of this is about getting content from inception to the consumer as fast as you can. It's not making any money in the middle. Just like news and sports, there's no value getting built here, but it is the value that you get on the back end.
But don't you think as time goes on that even though they're using less than 10% now, that in 5 to 10 years where there's other things going on or anniversaries that they're going to want to go back and say, was that Ford truck or whatever in right. the background, because now can they monetize that?
Oh, absolutely. So that's the thing is what's used today to get the job done is one thing.
Right.
From a historical perspective or an archive perspective, I mean, I was corrected one day when I was talking to somebody at the Library of Congress about libraries versus archives. And their position was, a library, something you check things in and out. So it's kind of a steady state, but it's usable. The archive is everything. It's everything in its original form, untouched. Because 20 years from now, the technology to pull that back out and do a better job and do more in-depth searches to do better things from noise reduction, color correction, all those things, they're going to be much better in 20 years than they are today. So yeah, so having all that data is, you don't want to ignore it. You're maybe ignoring it from an operational level today, but you want to have as much data as possible in your archives and your storage to be able to use later on. I mean, we are finding that, I mentioned earlier about different languages being different links. So there is, you know, certain technologies out there that are coming to market now where, and they've been around for a bit, but they can stretch or collapse the runtime, but just do it enough where visually you can't see the difference, but the reality is it's been stretched just enough so the audio is still in sync, so you're not spilling audio over to another frame. Closed caption is another painful thing. Now, one of the things that AI saw a test recently, some new AI tools, where it takes the 708 closed captioning and it looks at each collection of frames and it makes sure that the closed captioning doesn't come up and cover the person's face or cover, you know, when you're watching a sporting event and now suddenly it's covering the score. You know, things like that just annoy everybody, but, you know, and annoys people who really need it because they're hearing impaired, but they hate the fact that their screen's being blocked at the wrong time, wrong place for those types of things. Sure.
How do you view the financial data and the rights data, not the DRM, but like where you can use them, the territories, languages, and then what the obligations are related to that?
So yeah, that typically falls out on the distribution end. So there's more and more of the distributors. I mean, distributors are kind of locked in the way they deliver on the last mile perspective. But the information they get today is typically a separate file. It's a PDF or an Excel spreadsheet or a Word document. There's no tools built in to say, well, you can't change it into this language. Well, you can, but if you do this language, you have to add these credits because you did this other language. You have to switch the closed captioning and the subtitles. Today, that's all done manually. On the metadata side, we're using that to correct that downstream. So change the audio service mapping, change the captioning files so they match the ISO standard globally. But if you try to do that manually, it'd be, you know, 10 people a week, you know, spending all week doing it. From an automated sense, it happens automatically. There's nothing that we have to do to make that different. From the rights perspective, though, carrying that downstream does flag who it can actually deal with. So like a distributor who doesn't have the key for that particular data or that particular asset can unlock it. So sometimes it's purely on certification. Sometimes we have some customers who are doing it by hardware. I mean, it just depends on the security levels you want. Most government facilities, it's both hardware and software now. It used to be they moved mainly with the software, but because all the hacks that happened over the last 5 years, a lot of them are now running, you know, hardware keys as well as software keys. But the main thing is to be able to propagate the information that's done here on the business side to where it's appropriate downstream, which may have zero impact here, but the impact is on the distribution and the consumption of it.
Yeah. So you alluded to this burden of data being created by the explosion of AI engines, and as
we don't mind the data, but
yeah, of course. How would you suggest managing that burden, the number of engines that are producing this data that can be valuable?
So there are what we're looking at is a number of tools that look at what they call frame similarity. So they take each frame of video, that information that came back from the different sources, and they look, it looks at that and tries to find replications so that the information that came back is exactly the same data, so there's no reason to duplicate the data from that second or third or fourth source. So it just collapses that data into one data piece. So the other thing that's a challenge is how you look at all that. So one of the problems that companies like ourselves have, and of course our customers have, is you get all this data, how do you look at it? How can you search it? How can you find what's going on in it? How can you make it useful? So, and this is a good example. So people will ask, well, gee, what database do you use? Do you use an IBM database? Do you use an Oracle database? And the answer is, if anybody says you use one database, you just made a big mistake, because different databases are there for different reasons. If you look at Maria database is a relational data store. It's for workflows and jobs. It's great for tracking that. You can do hundreds of thousands of those, track them, search them in real time. But if you start looking at unstructured data through a SQL database, this thing's just going to die. If you put more than 10 people looking at it, it's just going to seize up. If you've got 2,000 people or 10,000 people looking at it, it'll never work. So you end up with these models where you use the right kind of SQL database to sub the right hook. We happen to use Mongo for our big data stores, for big data sets for search. That's okay, except for when you're looking at completely unstructured and graphical data, this doesn't work so well. Oranga works much better. Our feeling is, we're going to look at what all the biggest internet companies in the world are using, and we're going to use what they're using. Because they've done all the R&D, they've figured out what works, what scales, and all this is about scalability in the end. If you're scaling two times, three times, you can kind of live with what you've been doing, but when you're looking at like 10x, 20x, which is what AI is creating, then you've got to really change the model. So we have to use a full ELK stack, so for us Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana for visualization. Again, we try to use the tools. I think most people are going to try to use tools, whether it's us or people building their own systems or using other people's systems. It's about where do you go when it's scaled out? Where do you go when it's 10,000 users or 10,000 endpoints rather than two? We came from the other end, so we all came from the over-the-top space. So we're used to having tens of thousands of endpoints, where a lot of the other traditional, let's say, man workflow orchestration companies, they came from the studio or post-production space. Their scale has always been fairly small. For us, it's always been, you got to think the opposite. It's got to be, there could be 10,000 users. Do we have 10,000 users? No. On any system, we have some systems that have 500 concurrent users. AmFam, and actually a project with State Farm, looks like they're going to have probably about 4,000 users in the given time. So you have to be able to scale up, and that's, being able to manage big data. Is we don't want to get rid of the data. We want to make sure that if there are areas where there's rough replication, we dedupe that replication. At the same time, we need to give you the storage and the search capability to get to it and use it, and use it in a way that makes sense to your organization. Any other questions? Since they're opening the door, kicking us out.
I mean, there are two options. One is define a superset of all the data, right? And then centralize the data in maybe NoSQL or SQL database.
Right.
And then each processing of the workflow will share the data, right? Update the records in the centralized database.
Right.
The other one is for each processing of the workflow, we define different database. And then we just need to do the data conversion when the processing convert from the previous one to the next one.
That,
I mean, which option is better?
It's better to do the second because it's more dynamic. All those different layers were fixed today and they're going to be the same in 5 years. That's one. If that works. But when you start looking at each one of those different metadata models could change tomorrow, you know, literally, they need to be extensible. That's the problem, because they are going to change, they are going to have to be extensible, they are going to have to evolve. And to have one monolithic way of looking at it, you're back to building an Oracle or IBM database structure, which the database license alone is going to cost you $500,000. And to us, that's crazy. That's not the way to scale it up. We'd rather scale it out on a fractal level rather than on a monolithic level. So thank you very much for the